You're listening to Market Champions, a podcast on navigating the financial markets. Here's your host, Srivasa Prakash.
This episode of Market Champions is brought to you by Simplify ETFs. For more information, go to simplify.us. No Simplify ETFs will be discussed in this episode. Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Market Champions. Today I've got my friend Rachel Volinsky. Rachel is the CIO of Mercer Canada. Rachel, thank you so much for being on the podcast. It's wonderful to have you on.
It's a pleasure.
Rachel, you know, let's get started by talking a bit about your background. So, you know, in some ways it's unconventional because initially in university, you know, you studied criminology, you were working for the Israeli Defense Forces, and then you made that switch to finance. So could you talk a bit about your background, you know, how you got started in the industry and sort of your journey to joining Mercer Canada and where you are today?
Well, thanks, Sri. First of all, thank you for the compliment, the unconventional. I aim to be unconventional, so thank you for that. My background is I was in Israeli Defense Forces, and after the Israeli Defense Forces, I went to law school in Israel. And halfway through law school, my personal circumstances changed. And in my early 20s, I found myself in Canada. And I transitioned to U of T, University of Toronto, finished my undergrad, and straight out of undergrad, went to MBA school, frankly, because I didn't know what kind of career path is I am best suited for. And I figured that the 2 years will give me the opportunity to sort myself out, which turned out to be the right call. And while I was in MBA school, and by the way, I did very well there, and everything kind of came easy to me that was related to finance. So it's more gave me an opportunity to figure out where am I going to excel. And throughout sort of when I started out in the industry, I actually really wanted to be in private equity, but when I started out 96, it was not an industry that was having an easy time. So I ended up going into investment banking training program for one of the Canadian banks. And long story short, within 2 years, it gave me an opportunity to observe a lot of things. And that's why I advise younger people, just do sampling when you're younger to figure out what you really enjoy doing. And I migrated towards asset management. Within 2 years, I started my buy side career. So I kind of, the clock started ticking as far as I'm concerned in 98. I joined Ontario Teachers, TD Asset Management. Then from TD Asset Management, I joined Invesco Trimark. And then I decided to move. I moved to the States and I took a job, senior portfolio manager, head of research with Calvert Investments. It was the beginning of the ESG sort of discovery. And it interested me a lot, partially because I was so tired following the Canadian market kind of heavy in resources. And traditionally, those have been kind of bad businesses and very volatile. And I'm like, oh, I will get to kind of ignore those for a while. And I moved to the States, spent a few years there, and within 3 years came back to Canada and made another career transition towards more of supervisory sort of oversight initially at SCI Investments and subsequently here at Mercer Canada. And currently, my job is that of a CIO of Canada, and as well, I'm also the global head for Mercer Equity Portfolio Management team. So yeah, I have a lot to do at the moment.
Yeah, that's awesome. And you know, the fact that, you know, you're sort of running CIO, your CIO of Mercer Canada and a global head of equity portfolio management, I think that's very, very cool. And, you know, just to get started with that, so, you know, this year has been kind of relatively shabby for equities. And, you know, considering one, you know, you're the head of one, Mercer is one of the largest asset allocators in the world, and two, you know, you sort of the global head of equity portfolio management, you know, from a client standpoint, you know, what are clients really doing with respect to sort of the bloodbath that we've seen in equities? And then two, you know, how are the asset allocators broadly and Mercer thinking about it?
Well, you're clearly spending a lot of time with the doom and gloom people. As I can hear the bloodbath, the vernacular. So let's go to the beginning of the year when Fed started signaling that they're going to be serious about raising rates and QT. So the first quarter was all about duration. So rates have gone up, but risk assets haven't been that badly affected. And then Q2 came. So throughout all of this, for me, as I was fundamentally trained as a value investor, a lot of it was a breath of fresh air. So yeah, do I enjoy looking at my assets and my portfolios and kind of seeing some check back? Not really. But the years, the 2 years post-pandemic were very unusual 2 years. And everything that wasn't supposed to work was working. And everything that was supposed to work wasn't working. And someone with a very strong fundamental background and value tilt, even though that's not my core job at the moment, but it was frustrating insofar as I don't understand what's going on. You know, like all this speculation, all this, stocks that were already super expensive continue kind of to go to stratosphere, and dot-com mania 2.0 was in full force. So I would say the 2021 for me were probably more difficult years in terms of, I mean, just imagine everything you know, everything you trained for just doesn't apply. In fact, valuation was a liability. Right. Like if you wanted to apply any sort of traditional parameter of valuation, you probably were on the losing end. And you, right. If you wanted to keep up, you kind of had to compromise your beliefs and your philosophy.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah. And so in a way, what really happened in 2021 was we saw, in 2020 and 2021 was we saw a lot of these unprofitable, say, tech companies, we saw them go ballistic, go through the roof. And, you know, as you mentioned, and we saw them trade at ridiculous valuations. So I think
the point is
very interesting.
So for me, 2022, as painful as it was, there's price discovery. There's some price discovery, like you're getting some normalization in equities. You're seeing some normalization in credit spreads. It's very tough to make decisions when you don't have price discovery. And if everything is expensive and you have to be fully invested, as most of my clients are, it's a matter of what's going to fare better when reality will kind of, when gravity sets in. So this is not a bad environment as an investor. Do I think things will, it's going to be a bumpy road? Yeah, probably. And as it should be. This is where professionals kind of, this is an opportunity for professionals to shine.
Mm-hmm.
Do I have a sort of crystal ball? I think the future is quite foggy. I mean, we're probably going to get a little bit into what are the potential sort of pockets where black swans might come out. I don't take the view that all is sort of doom and gloom from now on.
Yeah, got it. Yeah, no, that makes sense. And, you know, one thing that we have started to see is the Fed initiating QT. And, is your view that, you know, QT has started, QT is sort of more or less priced in and into market, because the broad consensus argument is that QT is sort of not priced into market. And so, you know, as the Fed does more QT, tightens up more liquidity and tightens up financial conditions even further, we're likely to see equities, you know, head even lower from here. But what's your take on that?
So there's a lot to unpack here. Just coincidentally, I was listening to another podcast by Perry Merling, and he put it in a very good perspective that if we go back to the pandemic days, we had 2 years of pandemic and extremely loose monetary policy. And this is okay, because in a way it was war finance. So under war finance, the Federal Reserve, which is a US central bank, becomes sort of the bank of the government. And what does it mean? The government needs to finance the war. In some cases, there's a physical enemy. In this case, it was the pandemic. And they need to issue funds to fight the enemy. Mm-hmm. And whatever can be absorbed by the public will get absorbed by the public. But then it's if it can be absorbed, then the government needs to step in and absorb the issue, the needs of the government. So now we're probably at the end of the pandemic, maybe, maybe not, but hopefully we are. Mm-hmm. And the Fed is correctly trying to pull back and sort of withdraw some of this liquidity and this loose monetary policy. And it's unclear. It's really unclear. So the bear case is, oh, we've never been through such environment before. The Fed has never attempted to fight inflation and kind of withdraw monetary policy, QT, at the scale that it's attempting to do. So there's a lot of fodder, if you will, to scare market participants. And some of us were very successful in doing that. Now, the bear case is, you know, and I've seen some estimates, so the Fed has to go from 9 trillion to 5 trillion, and each trillion is the impact on tightening would be 25 to 75 basis points. Thanks, that's a great range. It'll give me lots to work with. So the truth of the matter is no one knows really how it's going to unfold. Are the monetary conditions going to be tighter? Probably, which is again not a bad thing. So on the other side of the this sort of again very bearish sort of apocalyptic scenario, there are some that say, yes, the Fed wants to tighten. Yes, the Fed wants to fight inflation, but it's not clear whether they will be able to. And if you look at some of the indicators, and clearly the forward yield curve with the expectation of how much is priced in, you ask me how much is priced in, it's kind of signaling that, you know, yes, the Fed has the appetite and they're sounding really hawkish, but by the end of the day, they might not be able to. So yeah, it's tough to say. It's tough to say. Listen, it's never easy. If it's too easy, you know that something is not right. And the way that I was trained and the way that I was sort of programmed to invest, conditioned to invest, you always kind of pick and choose the good companies you want to invest in for the long term, be it credit, be it alternatives, be it public equities. And those companies will produce value over the long run through many cycles. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Yeah. And so in a way, you know, when it comes to other asset classes, you know, how are you thinking through, say, fixed income? Because fixed income has definitely had fixed income. I remember reading somewhere that, you know, since the Declaration of Independence was signed or something, it was the worst for 6 months until the end of June and all of that. And you know, even today after that inflation print, you know, it's been interesting watching fixed income. You know, what are your thoughts on fixed income? You know, there's some people saying that, you know, over the course of the next year, we're likely to experience a recession or at least an economic soft patch. And we're likely to see inflation come down sooner rather than later. And so, you know, now might be the time to start adding some fixed income to your portfolio. You know, what's your take on that? You know, how are you thinking about fixed income markets here?
Yeah, so clearly you started the year with overpriced everything, overpriced fixed income, overpriced. And this is what I was kind of lamenting about. Like, how do you even think about generating 3.5% real return, with especially given the inflation? So clearly we started from an inopportune starting point. Mm-hmm. At this stage, it's starting to look better. Do I think there's more sort of pain to go through for spread assets, for high yield instruments, emerging market debts? Probably, but it's probably also time to start taking a closer look and start sifting through some of the opportunities. So as far as credit is concerned, yeah, there's a little bit kind of risk appetite in me that's starting to get interested. In the meanwhile, I would stay sort of short duration on the short end and align myself with companies that they're not going to default on you. So you're kind of, by the end of the day, if you're not, if you're getting paid, if you're getting your principal back and collecting a coupon along the way, and it's in on the shorter end of the maturities, you should be okay. Mm-hmm. So would I recommend at this point to go gung-ho into the riskier part of the market? Probably you have to exercise some caution with respect to equities. Were you gonna ask me about equities now? as a traditionally trained value manager, I'd like to think that value is going to do very well for a lengthy period of time. Again, all this stuff that wasn't working since we found ourselves in an ever declining ever declining interest rate environment. This is not good for value. So value needs inflation, not like too much inflation. That can be too much of a good thing. And value doesn't like super low interest rates, because remember, a value is a shorter duration assets compared to growth.
Right.
So when interest rates were declining, growth assets, that growth style that is, has longer duration, did better than value. So I'd like to think that the sort of the traditional value investing, disciplined value investing, still has a lot of legs here. There's some interesting growth opportunities. And again, not all, I'm not talking about unprofitable growth, but profitable growth. We've seen some tremendous compression in valuation. So there are opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Yeah. And you know, with the other big asset that's done sort of quite well this year has been commodities. And so, you know, we've seen various CDS strategies do okay. And we've just broadly seen the commodity complex start to trend after sort of a decade of, you know, trendless sort of mean reverting markets. And that's also been interesting to watch. And a lot of that has definitely been the function of what's going on in the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. And so, do you have any views on commodities, considering that, you know, at least for a little bit more, you know, we're likely to see some more inflation?
Yeah. So again, there's a lot to unpack here. Instead of focusing on commodities, let's talk a little bit about inflation as a whole.
Uh-huh.
Perhaps there were like few bubbles since the global financial crisis, and even before, that really don't have much to do with financial markets. We had abundance of goods and services that were manufactured in China. There's abundance of cheaper labor coming from China and other emerging markets, and cheap energy flowing from Russia and cheap commodities. So at the margin, you kind of unpack all those three conditions, and they all started to pivot even before the pandemic. Mm-hmm. So if you look at this whole picture of the Great Moderation, the period of great moderation, when everybody is getting along with each other and you have free flow of goods and services, you had free flow of commodities. Some parts of the world have given up on their own energy production and kind of succumbed to and relied heavily upon the cheap energy from Russia. So this was all very positive for the risk assets, for fundamental sort of support for valuations, for margins. And even before the pandemic, it started to change. So you saw US relationship with China started to, it took slightly different tone. Abundance of labor, labor became more expensive. And obviously pandemic, and then the war in Russia and Ukraine obviously affected the free flow of energy. So in this regard, yes, I think it's a fairly, you can paint a fairly bullish picture for commodities, because first of all, you don't have those great moderation conditions to support kind of more efficient flow of goods. And also there's another element, few elements. One is there was a lot of underinvestment in commodities. Mm-hmm. The shareholders penalized, especially the energy companies. If you probably don't remember, but I do, and I'll share with you. In probably before 2014, 2013, energy companies, exploration and production companies were encouraged to just produce. So every free dollar that they had at their disposal, they would plow it back into production. Mm-hmm. So they burnt a lot of money and investors got very agitated. So right now you have a double whammy in terms of investors want dividends and cash flow and return of capital. And you also have the environmental aspect. It's more expensive. You want companies needed to reinvest back in order to get more environmentally savvy. So, and on top of it, you had this whole sort of fossil fuel, kind of anti-fossil fuel attitude amongst investors. So the cost of capital for them became more expensive. So if you take all of this in combination, plus you layer on the Russia-Ukraine conflict, it paints a pretty bad picture for the world, you know, in that regard, but paints a pretty bullish picture for energy producers. In that regard, Canada is actually really well positioned. Our pipeline shortage notwithstanding, it's still the lowest, one of the lowest cost producers, and with abundant resources to harvest years to come. So yeah, I can see that. In terms of other, you can paint a similar picture with regards to the rest of the commodity complex. Again, it was underinvested. You have it's more of the supply issue other than demand. So the supply issue is a lot more difficult to fix. And in that regard, again, you had disruption of flow. The commodities are not as sort of flowing as freely. It is a lot, it takes more money to transport commodities from one place to another. Mm-hmm. So again, that's bullish for commodities. And obviously we can't forget the ESG and the environmental aspect. And a lot of the sort of clean energy decarbonization is actually good for commodities. I don't remember the exact numbers, but a electrical car uses more copper than an average house. So you have a lot of demand for industrial metals. And again, you had supply shortages because those companies underinvested. So yeah, you can paint a fairly bullish picture for commodities.
Okay, awesome. No, I think it's very true. And you know, we've sort of seen people talk about lithium, silver as well, in addition to copper, as potential commodities and commodity metals that are gonna benefit as a result of this transition towards ESG, because in addition to EVs, if you have, say, solar panels, et cetera, you know, those sort of metals, along with other rare earth metals, are going to be high in demand as a result of the shift towards ESG and towards, you know, greener energy initiatives. So it's going to be very, very interesting to watch. And structurally, I completely agree with you on sort of the bullish case. No, one thing that's been talked about a lot lately, and you know, you've sort of heard it from my boss Michael Green as well, is you get to see, so you know, for example, large asset managers, say Mercer, or even bigger, say BlackRock and Vanguard, you know, have so much in assets that, you know, a lot of their allocations, especially within their index fund products, has been moving the markets. You know, how far Now, do you agree with that? And if you do agree that, you know, they move markets, you know, do you think that's sort of a structural risk in the sense that, you know, flows, especially, you know, passive flows, end up being some sort of a risk to the market?
Well, it's very interesting. It's very interesting to follow. It's very interesting to wrap your head around, and it's clearly kind of the way I look at it. There was a trend in place, and mm-hmm. what you're describing, the indexation kind of turbocharged the existing trend.
Right.
I think we're seeing some of it in the reverse right now. When markets are selling off, here's kind of the heavier index names not necessarily doing the best. It's really tough. It's really tough to see. Technicals always was sort of my weakest area. I was trained on fundamentals of companies, but it definitely couldn't ignore it. And the fact that it has moved the market to a large degree. There's some, you know, I'm looking at some of the bigger sort of index providers, and it's interesting. Like, for instance, BlackRock has been in the news a lot about ESG indices. And it's not kind of clear what they're trying to do, whether they want to start moving towards ESG indices. And then they're getting a lot of blowback from regulators. So they're now kind of retrenching. So, so to me, technicals is something that you need to be aware of. But at the end of the day, fundamentals, in my opinion, in the long run, trump the technical trends. I don't know. I'm not an expert in this field by any stretch of imagination.
No worries. Now, are there any trends just within the asset allocator industry that, you know, you think it's worth for, say, retail and, you know, just say hedge funds, etc., to pay attention to?
Yeah, so the biggest question, I actually wrote about it not too long ago. I tried to write a quarterly CIO letter every quarter, and I try not to focus on kind of just what happened, but I try to digest and understand what does it really mean. And this quarter was one that was a particularly interesting quarter. And I never know how my CIO letters are going to end, because I start writing and then it kind of takes me into a certain direction. And this quarter, I chose to focus on, has anything materially changed? And I kind of came to a conclusion that at least it's worth kind of pausing and pondering whether something has indeed changed. And I'm not going to say it's like changed, there was a pivotal change, but more, you know, maybe the last 14 years were a bit of an aberration.
Mm-hmm.
And we're kind of going back to the future in terms of how things were before we had this great moderation, ever declining interest rates, sort of since the financial crisis. That's kind of where my thinking is. My thinking is that, especially the last 2 years, I mean, those were pretty unnerving things to watch. A lot of things that we conditioned to take for granted, for instance, you asked about fixed income. So fixed income, because interest rates declined so much, it became, instead of being an asset, kind of income producing asset, it became a hedging instrument. And some market participants probably helped themselves too much to it as a hedging instrument. And obviously, I'm not going to criticize very successful investors, but the whole risk parity paradigm, you know, it's kind of a little bit sort of artificial invention, whereas you kind of try to mimic the risk return of equities with fixed income just through leverage. So it always had a bit of an alchemic, I hope I pronounce it correctly, touch, a smell to it. So, and when you think about it, I actually came across a very interesting paper that if you look at kind of 10-year, 15-year historical volatility and historical volatilities by asset classes, and you try to extrapolate it in the future, you're kind of getting a little bit of a distorted picture. And what do I mean by that? Yes, if you look 10 years out, fixed income securities tend to look far less volatile than, for instance, equities, because you have a long time to recover. So volatility, when you look, and not just for equities, all the asset classes, when you look 10 years out, based on the previous 10, 15 years, you probably underestimating the volatility and underestimating the correlation of assets. So if you kind of look at shorter horizons, and this is actually one of the things that I'm trying to experiment in my world, what are those volatility assumptions look like if you shorten the horizons? And when you start plugging in those volatilities and those correlations, all of a sudden you're starting to get a different picture. And right, you're asking me, why am I boring you with all those correlate multi-horizon volatility and correlation? And in my opinion, what if we go back to the future, to the previous, to the regime that we had before the great financial crisis, you will, I think many market participants underestimated the risk. I think it will have implication for risk budget. Mm-hmm. So what some market participants, in my opinion, will discover that they underestimating the amount of risk that they've taken in their portfolios and their desire to achieve their journey. So I think that will be a profound change. It might not happen over time, but that, in my opinion, will have a considerable implication for the next probably 5 to 10 years. If my thesis is indeed correct, and we're going back to a regime pre sort of global financial crisis and even earlier.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, one of the interesting points that you made was sort of this changing role in the way fixed income has behaved. So, you know, fixed income used to historically be something that, you know, you could count on as a hedge in case of recession, et cetera. And, you know, it would be considered a safe asset. But, you know, now, at least what we've seen over the last past few months is that, you know, fixed income has sold off quite rapidly. And even prior to that, what we observed was that, you know, fixed income used to yield, say, 1%, 2%. And the aftermath of 2020 was less than the 10-year used to yield less than 1%. And that was interesting. And, you know, I wanted to get your thoughts. Do you think, you know, the old idea of a 60-40 portfolio where, you know, you allocated 60% of the portfolio to equities, 40% to bonds, fixed income, you know, do you think that sort of framework of thinking about portfolio construction is dead?
Well, again, I wouldn't go as far as dead. bloodbath, dead. I wouldn't say it's I wouldn't go as far as kind of cancel everything. But I do agree that again, we would have to revisit the way we look at diversification and revisit the way we look at risk budget. So that is for sure. Now, duration is it's not clear cut anymore, given what I kind of described at the beginning. Yes, the Fed is tightening. Yes, the Fed is raising rates, but how far can they go? Mm-hmm. It's in many cases, the Fed tried and kind of failed. And it's not clear. So if we, if the narrative of some experts is correct, we're probably gonna have a mild recession, or I'm not gonna opine on degree of mildness of the recession. We have recession. Recession is all about demand destruction. And demand destruction, clearly consumer and corporates will be pulling back. And that is actually what the market is telling you, be it the forward yield curve, being the forward euro dollar curve. This is what the market is telling you, that yes, the Fed wants to, but they likely not be going to be successful. So in that regard, duration, sort of the long dated interest rates, have value. And so again, it's not clear cut. And you, at this point, when rates are, I didn't see what the 10-year today, but it's probably through 325 or some such US 10-year. At these levels, probably duration has some value. So you might be wise to start, and everybody's so negative on it. So that's the beauty of the hedge. Everybody, you need to hedge when the instrument is out of favor. Now, there's other implication for diversification outside of fixed income. Anything that had sort of the long volatility strategies, be it long short, being some sort of long volatility strategies that are based on derivatives, even gold, I would lump it into the long volatility strategy bucket. So you look at this bucket, and it clearly didn't work in the last 10 years.
Right.
In the last 14 years. But again, to me, this has value right now. So if you want to diversify, and it's actually has risk mitigation properties. And funny enough, a lot of it's even internally, like people asking, you know, hedge funds, we think of them as risky, as obviously you have to mind the leverage, you have to mind what they're actually doing. But if it's a prudent long short strategy, this is actually a decent risk mitigant. Mm-hmm. Now, jumping to equities, a little bit away from the 60-40 portfolio. And actually, before I go to equity, sorry, I have so much happening in my head here. I actually want the 60-40 portfolio to stop working, because honestly, it kind of put everybody to shame. Diversification, like, you know, regional diversification, the best sort of portfolio for the last 14 years has been indeed the 60-40 portfolio. And right. If you levered it, you would have been way to the races. So I kind of want it to stop working. I don't want it to die, but I want it to stop working as well as it did. So all those wonderful skills that myself and my colleagues have accumulated over the course of our careers would become actually applicable again. So again, I mentioned long, short strategies, some of the real assets, as we discuss commodities, alternatives like private market assets, again, selectively, mine the leverage, mine speculation. Obviously, experts are in best position to assess it. In jumping to equities, it will be interesting to see the sort of one thing I will challenge is, and I'm challenging myself, if you look at sort of, we kind of conditioned to think that higher volatility strategies have to give you higher return. Mm-hmm. And I kind of encourage market participant to not every risk is going to pay off. So with all this sort of great moderation breaking down, emerging markets is clearly hasn't worked in the last 10 years. It's been a very disappointing asset class. Mm-hmm. It's going to remain challenged given the dynamics of emerging markets. There are clearly opportunities, but again, I wouldn't rush to buy emerging market ETFs. I like active management in emerging markets. The same with small caps. So there's a lot of things that probably will come back into vogue. You know, our own country, Canada, many market participants have given up on Canada. In mm-hmm. Canada, actually, it had very strong couple of years, 21, 22. It's been actually very well performing equity class. And many have given up on Canada. And now with this sort of newer, back to older but newer regime, something like Canada, which is uncorrelated, not uncorrelated, but loosely correlated to other developed market, given the commodities exposure of that market, might be a good way to think about diversification. So I kind of, in my letter, I encouraged everyone to think of everything that didn't work and why it didn't work. So, you know, something like, you know, Turkey didn't work. It didn't work for a good reason. So that's not a good reason to think about it as a good diversifier, but there are legitimate asset classes. Maybe I'm looking at it as a contrarian investor that we really need to kind of put on our radar screens again, as I enumerated a bunch of them.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, no, I can already visualize the title. Be like, you know, Rachel Blinsky wants 60/40 dead. With that, Rachel, you know, I wanted to wrap up the podcast. And before I let you go, you know, do you have any closing thoughts? And, you know, could you tell the audience a bit more about where they can find you, Mercer Canada, and more of your work?
Sure. Maybe I'll spend a few minutes just explaining what we do. I'm part of a bigger business for Mercer. It's called Investment Solutions. And what we're doing, really, we're assets aggregators. And if you have a subscale pension fund or insurance company or endowment and foundation, and again, it's subscale is in the eyes of the beholder, but we can provide a lot of services, and it's a gamut of services, and depending on your on the client's willingness to outsource and the client's willingness to stay involved. So mm-hmm. it's a gamut of services. In some cases, we're doing it all. We're asset allocation, rebalancing, diversification, risk management services, really holding the client's hand throughout their journey. In some cases, when the client is more sophisticated, typically they have more assets and they have boards of trustees that want to stay more involved, then it's a little bit scaled down version of our services. But our value proposition is we're better together than on our own. So we aggregate smaller assets together. We get scale, we get better fees, and we disseminate in an efficient manner Mercer intellectual capital.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Awesome. And so, you know, you're sort of the CIO of the Canadian arm for investment solutions. So I think that's
And if you want to find me, I'm on LinkedIn. I live on LinkedIn. I'm not an active, I don't post actively. Maybe I should, but I'd be happy if whoever wants to reach out, please do. I like to think I'm quite responsive.
Awesome. With that, Rachel, thank you so much for being on the podcast. It was wonderful having you on.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you for listening to Market Champions. To never miss an episode, make sure to subscribe, and we'll see you next time.